welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe. I'm one of your co-hosts, and you're going to be hearing me today just at the top and at the end of this episode because we have something a little bit special for you today. In just a little bit, you're going to hear Kelsey interviewing Maureen Lee Lanker, who is the author of It Happened One Fight, a new release set in 1930s Hollywood. And they have a really fabulous discussion about all sorts of things. Maureen has a really, really interesting job and career, and I think you guys are going to really enjoy that. So without any further ado, I will see you at the end of the episode for just a couple of little notes, but I hope you enjoy our interview with Maureen Lee Lanker. Hello, and welcome to Tea and Strumpets. I'm Kelsey. I am joined today by Maureen Lee Lanker, who is a debut author. Her new book is out shortly when you're listening to this. It'll either be right before or right after. So we're here to talk to her today about her new book. But hello, Maureen. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Kelsey. Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. So this has been a long time coming. So for listeners, Maureen and I have a mutual friend who is, hi, Kristen. I know you're listening. Hi.
Hi, Kristen.
she's a good friend to both of us. And so we met many years ago briefly at a thing. Kristen's like, Maureen's great. Kelsey's great. Meet. And so as we have both been doing things in the world, Kristen's like, Maureen, Kelsey's doing a thing. And then she's like, Kelsey, Maureen's doing a thing. You should talk to Maureen. And I'm like, Maureen's great. Let's do something. So we're finally doing something.
Woo! Thank you, Kristen.
Yes. So while today we're here to talk about your book, I have one question just to break the ice and really help us get into the mood. And we're going to start with our favorite question to ask, which is, what is your favorite romance novel and why?
Okay, well, I did come prepared for this because it is a challenging question, but my favorite romance novel is One Good Earl Deserves a Lover by Sarah McLean. Mm-hmm. And it is part of her series that's about a secret gambling club that a lot of aristocrats go to. And this one in particular is about Lady Philippa Marbury, who is a super smart and bespectacled woman who loves science and laboratories and is way more into that than the marriage market. And she ends up crossing paths with one of the co-owners of this gambling hell, Cross, who is like kind of a martyr, and he feels like he has to be alone to make up for the sins of his past. And she's pretty determined to like be with him. And I don't know, it's my favorite because, well, A, Sarah McLean's my favorite romance author. I just think everything she writes is incredible. But that one in particular, I think, just checks all the boxes of like, it's really sexy, but both Cross and Philippa are such distinct, interesting characters. I'm a sucker for like smart blue stocking ends up with rakish man.
Our who favorite doesn't want heroines. That for their life? Exactly. Yeah. Our favorite bookish heroines end up with the rake. It's my favorite thing as well. Is that the one where he like does all the boxing matches? Like he's the boxer too?
Nope. Nope. That's No That's Good Duke Goes Unpunished. That's the one right after One Good Earl, which is, it's also great. Oh. I just love One Good Earl because Cross is very good at math and Philippa loves science. Yes. So they have these like really nerdy conversations together, which I'm a huge nerd. So I find that really hot. Yeah.
Yes. That's a great series. A super good one. I mean, we love Sarah McLean here. Big fans, big fans. So you really can't go wrong with any of her books, really. So
I agree with you. That's a good one. And I love a rakish hero who has a secret nerdy side and he falls for the nerdy girl. What can I say?
Yeah. And then that Rules of Scandal series was actually like one, I think, my first Sarah series. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, this author is so incredible. I have to read everything she's ever written. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I finally did end up reading her whole library, which is great, except for the fact that now I have to wait for all the new books to be published and it takes forever.
Let me tell you, I have an ARC of Knockout and I just started it last night and it is already, I'm so hooked.
I've been so excited for it. I just like right? love this series so much. I've been so excited. Imogen is just like my favorite. So.
It's already like firing on all cylinders. I am so into it. Like the Hell's Bell series, I feel like each book she's just been one-upping mm-hmm. herself. Mm-hmm. And I'm only like 40 pages into Knockout and I'm already like, okay, well, I loved Heartbreaker, but I think I already like this one more.
Oh, so great. I cannot wait. I've already pre-ordered it. I'm just like waiting for the day that it comes available to me. Super. So I love getting started. We could gush about Sarah McLean forever. However, I want to talk to you a little bit more about you and what do you do? How'd you get here? So for anyone who doesn't know, Maureen works for EW and she started out, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just remembering my conversations with Kristen. she started out, she's doing some work for them and then she became the romance novel reviewer. And so, yes. And since then you've done some amazing things. You've met actual stars like Andrew Garfield and Brett Goldstein, or I don't know, Kermit the F and Frog. Like what the what?
Definitely my dream celebrity to me. And he lived up to the hype. my boyfriend calls Kermit my other boyfriend because there's a picture of us hugging and it makes him very jealous.
just blown up across the wall. Just be like, it's the Kermit and Maureen show. You're secondary. Sorry.
Sorry. You're not part of this. What's actually really funny is that I used a picture of me and Kermit and Miss Piggy and Gonzo and Robin and Brett Goldstein from this interview we did about Muppet Christmas Carol on my Christmas card this last mm-hmm. year. And it said, God bless us, everyone. It had that picture. And, my boyfriend is a dark-haired, tall man, a little swarthy. Mm-hmm. And so multiple people did, in fact, think Brett Goldstein was my boyfriend. And I was not really that quick to correct them.
You're like in a world like, baby, I love you, but still in a world.
Oh, the day that I was going to do that interview, my boyfriend was like, all right, so if you two end up getting married, I will officiate. Oh, I give no. you full permission Frozen. To leave me for Brett Goldstein.
yes, I would 100% agree. I actually was able to see Brett Goldstein's live show. Like he did a comedy special in San Francisco and I like pre-ordered the tickets and I got it on the first day. Like I got to see the whole like live thing and I was just dying. It was so great. It was so worth it. Like, but when I saw those tickets come up, I was like, bye, 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 bye. I had an alarm set for the pre-sale. I was like, I'm getting into this. Do not stop me. Very good. So I'm extra jealous that you've actually met the man in person.
But I'm jealous you got to go to that show. I bet it was amazing. He keeps announcing shows and I'm like, come to Los Angeles. How hard is it?
I know he's in San Diego, which is close, but not really.
No, I know. But I love that you set an alarm because like in the past, I got up at like 2 or 3 in the morning to buy tickets to see Benedict Cumberbatch in Hamlet. So I feel your dedication.
Yes. There's not many things that I feel like that level of dedication to, but like that one, I was like, oh no. And at the time it was one show. I mean, he ended up adding shows, but when it was announced, it was one show. And I was like, I'm yeah. getting in. I will not miss this. Oh, so good. So yeah, tell us about your journey and how you became the romance novel reviewer. That's a great job.
Yeah. So I started at EW as an intern, and I was actually kind of still early in my romance journey. Like, I had always been in love with love and love stories, and growing up, my favorite part of any movie was the romantic plot, and I loved romantic comedies, and everyone who knows me knows I've always been a hopeless romantic, but it somehow, like, took me a while to get around to actually reading, like, romance with a capital R as a genre. I read a lot of YA growing up. That was definitely romance YA. But then I would say the first, like, technical romance novel I read was Mia Thermopolis from The Princess Diaries. Wrote with finger quotes a romance novel. So I read that. And then, yeah, like, right before I started at EW, I started getting really into romance fiction. And I had, for a freelance job, interviewed B and Leah Koch of The Rip Bodice in Los Angeles, and was already starting to dip my toes in the water, but they were so encouraging and lovely and pointed me in the direction.
But they are just encouraging and lovely. We've been able to talk to B on the podcast here, and it was really great when we were down at the LA Book Festival. I actually got to meet her in person. I was like, hi, we talked like 2 years ago over the internet. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, they're so great. So they really, like, helped me get super into it. And then I did something on romance, or I was talking about it with an editor at work. And I mentioned it to Leah when I was in the store, because I go in there a lot. And she was like, oh, like, you should tell her that you know us. So I told my editor that. And then it turned out EW had been looking for someone who was interested in reviewing romance for, like, a really long time.
What?
And so they were like, yeah, why don't you just do a column and reach out to publicists, and if we like it, we'll keep doing it. And yeah, that's what happened. And I was still an intern, and I wrote it, and it was supposed to be an online column. And then Tina Jordan, who was the books editor at the time, liked it so much she made it the lead in print for that week when we still had a print magazine, RIP. Yeah, so, and then it just kind of, from there, it took off, and I've been at EW a little over 6 years now. The column was monthly for my first 3 or 4 years, and then we switched to quarterly because I'm also work full-time there as a reporter for film and TV and theater, and I was just getting to be too much to read that much a month, so we switched to quarterly. But it's still going strong. Hot stuff. It's seasonal now, so the next one, we just had one in May for spring reads, and the next one will be up in August for the summer.
Fabulous. That is so great. I love, again, just romance community, like, helping each other. And it's just little things. It's like the encouragement. And I love this only because every author we've spoken to has talked about just the support from other romance authors and just their unwavering support and love and encouragement. And everyone's had a very similar story. And I love that, like, even with B and Leah, who just run a bookstore, not just any bookstore, I will say, an amazing one. But, you know, they run a bookstore, and even still they're like, do it, encourage, say you know us, give us a shout out, like, do the thing. And it's panned out. So that's just extra nice to hear.
Yeah, there's – as I was first getting into romance and first starting the column, like, that was something that really motivated me to keep going, was that sense of community, and that so many authors and readers are just each other's cheerleaders and here for each other to give each other advice. And, you know, like any community, there can certainly be difficult people and outliers and hard times, but I do think overall, everyone is just really supportive of each other and wants to celebrate the fact that we all love to read and some of us love to write this genre. So,
well, you know, all the writers are also readers, so we can't help
it. It's true.
But so I also wanted to talk to you about, so, like, one of your, if I remember correctly, you had a big cover story for the magazine around Bridgerton. And so I'm curious, because you started becoming the romance reviewer around the same time as Bridgerton, you know, was being announced and coming out. And that's been a huge boost for the genre. More people, even this podcast, people discovered it after we did our episodes about the series. They loved it so much. They like Googled it and then they found our show. Hi, all of you. Thanks for listening. But so how was that impactful on your career and about that opportunity to do that interview?
Yeah. So, well, it's funny. I was actually in the airport in Denver coming home from the Romance Writers of America conference that had been in Denver that summer. I was waiting to board my plane to come home so that I could go to Comic-Con with EW. So two like big fandom communities and going from one con to another, basically.
Yeah.
And while I was in that airport, the news broke that Shondaland had optioned Bridgerton. And this was a good year or two before the show actually premiered. And so I like immediately was like freaking out on Twitter. I emailed my editors. I was like, this is going to be huge. This is going to be like Outlander sized in fandom and scale, if not bigger. Yeah. And I honestly feel like it's probably been a little bit bigger. And was just like on it from the moment they announced the deal. Now, I will say, anyone who's a romance reader knows that a healthy degree of skepticism comes with people who are not romance readers. And my editors were very skeptical. And we ended up doing a feature on the first season, which was great. But I had been like, we need to like tackle this on all levels. And my editors were very skeptical and we didn't. And then it became the most watched show on Netflix ever.
It exploded.
The editor who had turned me down literally sent me an email that was like, I am sorry, I was wrong. And I won't doubt you. And so then when it was coming around to season two, it was like, well, obviously, Maureen was right the first time.
We'll listen to her this time. She knows what's happening.
We should do a cover story. And so then, yeah, we got to go out to London in the midst of the Omicron COVID spike.
Fun.
Right before Christmas. Thankfully, none of us on our crew got stuck in a hotel for Christmas. We're all really grateful for that.
Huge.
And we went to this amazing, like, very posh hotel in London and shot in a bunch of their rooms all day. And I got to meet Claudia Jassy, who plays Eloise, Nicola Coughlin, who plays Penelope, and Luke Newton, who plays Colin, and then Charitha Shanjan, who played Edwina in season two. And it was just like a really magical day interviewing about the show and getting to observe the photo shoot and sort of interject my knowledge of the books and the genre into what we were doing. Me and my video producer wrote a really fun video PSA of how to avoid a scandal. And then we also did like a whole video series on romance tropes. And it was, you know, it was so great to be able to write this cover story that was not only source material I was passionate about and sort of able to tell this story of how Bridgerton was legitimizing this genre that's been really condescended toward for so long. And just getting to write that story was really empowering and exciting for me. But then to also be able to take things like the tropes or the like scandals and turn them into this really fun content with the cast. And they were so fun and willing to play along. And it was a really good time.
I love that. I'm like so excited just hearing about it. And I know it was even a while ago and I'm like, oh, yay.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And I can't wait for season three. I loved Queen Charlotte and I want season three to be here now. So
yeah, I'm really excited. I'm also excited that like I heard, you know, that season three was delayed because they like Shonda got it into like production and then she was like, no, something's not right. We got to go back. And I'm like, yes, I don't know what you just I mean, you decided like the story wasn't right, but I'm here for it. You know, like I will say like anyone who knows, like, season two was really good. And I was sitting there watching it with someone who was like, no knowledge of Bridgerton, no knowledge whatsoever. It was so funny because afterwards, like, some friends and like the group, like the females who watched it, they were like, Kelsey, I watched the show. I think you might like it. And I was like, oh yeah. They're like, yeah, it's called Bridgerton. I was like, girl, I've been waiting for this since it was announced. I can tell you way too much about this.
Well, and it's funny because season two, that's my favorite book.
Yeah, same.
So I was super excited that that's the season we did the cover for because I love that book. I love Anthony. I love Kate. Mm-hmm. And it obviously was very different from the book, but I'm someone who's very much like, let me hold this adaptation as like a completely different entity from the book I love. One does not cancel out the other, and I can like them both for different reasons.
I agree. And it was one of those things, like even watching it, like I was watching it with my like unknown Bridgerton friend who was just really into the show. And I made her binge the entire show in one night. And she was like, I'm tired. I need to go home. And I was like, there's one episode left. I need you to power through right now. And so like, you know, we watched it and I was like, no, but I understand why you made that choice. Like, and I was like, this did not happen. And I was like, but this was, I understand why. Like, it's definitely one of those things where I can see where things don't necessarily translate to film versus a book. I understand you cannot completely duplicate a book on film. I understand that.
And here's the thing. I think you could do more of a one-to-one if it was a movie, but a series that is going to have 8 to 10 hour-long episodes, yeah. Like there is the way the arc of a romance novel and the beats that occur, there's just not enough there to sustain that many hours of television.
Agreed.
So you either have to make something shorter, like a feature film, or you have to do what Bridgerton has done and like have story that is not on the page and change things up. And that's just the way it works because honestly, if they followed the book note for note, that would be like 3 episodes.
And that's fine. I love Lady Danbury. And if she's like in every episode, I'm not going to complain. I love her. The thing is, I love her in book form and I love her in the series as well. She's great. If she's in every episode, I will not complain.
Well, and I just loved Queen Charlotte so much, and that's not even, I mean, she was not a character in the novels, really.
Yeah, I liked that interplay. It was really, I liked what they did there.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm really interested to see. I will say my one disappointment regarding Bridgerton is that I had really hoped that the huge success of the show would mean that there would be this flood of other romance adaptations because there is so much incredible source material out there, whether it's the books of Sarah McLean that we were talking about earlier, or Alyssa Cole has both a great contemporary series about sort of reluctant royalty, but also a really great historical series about spies during the Civil War. Alicia Rye has this amazing like super soapy series that the CW should have been making for the last like 4 years. I don't know. There's just like, I could talk for like 4 hours about all the series and books that would make incredible television or feature films.
Agreed.
And I am a little sad that I feel like people credited Bridgerton's success more to Shondaland and less to the genre, which no disrespect to Shondaland, like they make incredible product and have a proven track record. So I understand where that point of view would come from. But I do wish that this had prompted sort of more love for the genre as a whole.
Yeah, and I think that was something we were really hoping for too, just as far as like the different shows or even just the movies coming out. You know, I feel like there's just been a big recycle phase where it's just like we're recycling the same things. We're just remaking one movie after another. And like there's so much great source material. And even if you cut out all like the heavy sex out of the book itself is still really good. And most of the romance novels actually are not that heavy sex. Like there's some that are spicy, but there's plenty where there's like maybe 1.5 intimate scenes and the rest is all just plot and character development.
And also it's just, you know, I don't understand. There's so much source material with this built-in fandom. Like, why do you not want to take advantage of that? These people are going to buy tickets or subscribe to your streaming service to watch this thing because they're not being fed a diet of it outside of books.
No, and that's the thing, is it was so funny after Bridgerton, I heard a comment and they're like, well, you know, romance, like someone was acting, they were like, well, you know, romance novels are actually one of the best-selling genres during the recession and during times of hardship. Their sales don't drop. Like, they don't drop. If anything, they go up.
Because people want to be reassured and read something happy when everything else is falling apart around.
Yeah, when people ask me about romance novels and what it is, I'm like, look, a romance novel is book candy. I don't read it for intellectual thought or to like make me question my life choices. I read it because I want to have a happily ever after. I want the main characters to fall in love. I want them to have some kind of hurdle they need to get over. And I want it all to come together. And I want to be able to read it in 4 to 5 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I mostly am reading before bed, and mm-hmm. I don't want to read something that's going to devastate me or be so disturbing that then I have nightmares about it. Like,
yeah.
I was recently reading a best-selling piece of literary fiction, which I will not name because I don't want to disparage it, and I loved it, actually. I mm-hmm. thought it was a brilliant book, one of the best-written pieces of literature I've read in a while. But it had this plot point about a mass shooting, and mm-hmm. I had like nightmares for 2 nights after reading it. And yeah. I don't regret reading the book. It was incredible. But I'm like, this is why I read romance, because yeah. I don't have nightmares when I go to sleep after reading romance before bed.
That's fair. I mean, when I'm not reading romance, I'm reading like fantasy, and there's like heavy fantasy with like some romance subplot. And then there's like the romance fantasy, which is having its day on Bookstagram, which is great because I've had so many books to read. But it's like, what's nice is like, even when there's a war happening there or devastating things, I'm like, it's a world of fiction. It is not yeah. real in any way, shape or form. But, and it's not to say that a romance novel can't devastate you right before bed.
It can.
Because it can. I've definitely had that happen. But again, you know that like you can have that moment of devastation. It's not going to hold on. You're not going to hold on to it. And you will, you know, even when it looks dark, the ending will be happy.
Yes, exactly. You don't have nightmares because you have this HEA promise where you're mm-hmm. like, okay, yes, like I just sobbed my eyes out, but now I can go to sleep and rest easy because I know when I pick it up tomorrow, things will be resolved.
Exactly. Exactly. Super. Well, this is actually a great segue as far as talking about book adaptations. So your book takes place in the 30s in old Hollywood. And so aside from, so with that, and I know you host a podcast as well regarding film and movies, correct?
Yes.
So like, what is your fascination with film and old Hollywood?
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up being really into classic Hollywood. I think part of it was that I wasn't allowed to watch PG-13 until I was 13 and
oh, me
until
too.
I was 17.
Me too.
And so a lot of classic films are unrated mm-hmm. because the rating system didn't come in until like the late 70s, early 80s. And so that was a lot of what I would watch, like the Disney Channel and TCM. So that was kind of my film education growing up, as opposed to just watching whatever was coming out at the time. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, I think, how I fell in love with it. But I don't know. It's just been always been something about the period that's really fascinating to me. I have always been really drawn to storytelling in that era. I'm a huge history nerd in general. I was mm-hmm. a history major in college, like, from fourth grade on, I was like obsessed with the Tudors. I've always been really fascinated with different historical eras. And I've also always been a huge lover of movies and film. And so mm-hmm. I think in some ways, like being into old Hollywood allows me to combine those two interests in a sense.
That's fair. It's funny you say that about not being able to watch movies until like my parents were so strict about like those rules. Like it is insane. But it's so funny because I also grew up watching old movies. I have a collection yeah. of old musicals. I'm in love with an old musical. I also just have old movies in general. Like for a long time, like, my favorite movie was, like, what, My Girl Friday?
Like, oh, His Girl Friday.
His Girl Friday. Sorry, you're right. His Girl Friday. God, I'm terrible with names, but His Girl Friday. And it just was like, I saw it for the first time and it was like that perfect transatlantic banter, chit chat, you know, like I was like, yes, I love this, you know, throw in a little film noir murder mystery kind of plot. Oh, like, yeah. Sold.
Well, one of my, I would say my like gateway drug, even though I had watched classic films before this and certainly enjoyed them, but like my first real obsession was Gone with the Wind. And of mm-hmm. course, that is a romance. It doesn't end happily, but it's a lush love story mm-hmm. with a lot of ups and downs. And that was what made me fall in love with it, was like Scarlett and Rhett and that love story, but also the costumes and mm-hmm. the sets. And I could not get enough of like behind the scenes stories. And I think I've probably read every book ever written about the making of the movie. And that was really what first got me into it and captured my imagination. And having sort of that dual thing of the product of the movie that is so magical and holds your attention, but then at the same time has this like really rich and interesting story behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And understanding that, you know, every single film that you watch could have that. And that was kind of my first exposure to that and really wanting to start to learn about that or try to find out that information anytime I watched a film. And, but yeah, it's funny. A lot of people ask me about like my parents being super strict about that and if I'm resentful of it. And I'm always like, no, because it introduced me to things that I probably wouldn't have encountered otherwise and mm-hmm. really helped shape who I am as a person. And to be honest, I might do the same thing with my own kids because of the positive impact it had on my life in the long run.
Oh, I'm for sure going to show them problematic movies from the 40s and then explain the problematic things, but also why we love them.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Like one of my favorite, and I love it, no, but for, I think like one of my good friends, we were really into musicals and I was like, I got a musical for you. She's like, oh yeah. And I was like, it's called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
We're watching it.
And like to this day, my husband had like no idea what was happening. It was like around the 4th of July and my stepmom calls to tell me that like PBS or whatever, or Turner Classic Movies is showing Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And my sister is over, who also watched this with me a million times. And she was like, and I was like, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers on TV. I have the movie. We could watch this at any time. Nope.
But you gotta turn it on.
We play it. It's like in the middle of a song. And there's just my sister and I like belting and dancing in front of the TV. And my husband and one of our friends is over and he's like, what is going on? And I was like, you don't need to worry about it. We're having a great time.
One of my best friends from college, who I actually co-host my podcast with, mm-hmm. It's her all-time favorite movie. And she got married in June last year, specifically
My sister just got married in June, and they were originally talking about an October wedding, but then the June date came up, and my sister's like, I kind of want to be a June bride.
Well, that was – so my friend Oriana was like, I don't care about anything for my wedding in terms of like a specific date or setting, but I do really want to get married in June because mm-hmm. I want to be a June bride because of this song.
Because you're a bride for your life. You're a bride all your life. Come on.
Yeah. And then I officiated and I had like a bunch of quotes from Seven Brides for Seven Brothers in the ceremony. It's great. It's great.
I love that. I love that so much. Okay. I could go on about old musicals forever. We're not even going to talk about my, it's almost. I mean,
you're really going to love book two because it's about making a musical.
So. Yes. Is it like Singing in the Rain status?
A little bit. It's more inspired by like Swing Time and Cover Girl, but that the hero is definitely based on Gene Kelly. So.
I mean, because Gene Kelly is the most manly man ever, and he can sing and he can dance and he is so inherently masculine you don't even know what's going on.
I don't know if you've seen The Pirate, but Gene Kelly's short shorts.
The Pirate. Yes, Judy Garland. My God.
His short shorts in that movie are quite possibly the hottest thing I've ever seen. Also, like, I don't smoke. I don't think people should smoke. It's bad for your health. But that scene where he like takes the cigarette from the woman's mouth and then swallows it in his own mouth so he could kiss her. Like, what the fuck is that?
It's just fucking Gene Kelly being Gene Kelly.
I know.
Okay. I'm so glad. I love meeting a fellow human who's like, Gene Kelly is the hottest man ever.
Yeah. Oh my God. Smash me with your thighs, Gene Kelly.
I would sit, like, you could do an entire impromptu ballet solo for me, and I will just be like here for it from start to finish.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I don't even know where I was going with that. Got sidetracked by Gene Kelly so hard. Oh, I was going to say, because my other go-to, I've seen him a zillion times, and it's June now, which means it's close to 4th of July. I don't know about you, but The Music Man is the only movie you watch on 4th of July.
I actually always watch Yankee Doodle Dandy, another great classic musical.
Also great classic musical.
I do love The Music Man. At the TCM Festival this past April, I got to see Shirley Jones in person.
Wow.
At a screening of it, which was really special.
That's so special.
Yeah.
I love
it.
Yeah. I feel like it's so funny. Even like if it was just me in my house by myself, I'm like, I just need to watch The Music Man. It's fine.
I get that.
Awesome. Okay. So we've touched on this. Your book takes place old Hollywood. We've talked about the fascination. So when was your inspiration for this book? Like, when did you decide, I'm going to sit down and write this book and it's going to be like full blown. It's going to be old Hollywood. And it's going to be great.
Well, as we've kind of established, I've always been obsessed with that world. And like in high school, we had to do a video project in drama. And I wrote like an original film noir and Ooh. Shot it in black and white and edited it in iMovie. So I've always wanted to tell stories in that space. Mm-hmm. But in terms of this book and it being the first in a series, I got the idea from interviewing Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder mm-hmm. when they were making this film, Destination Wedding.
She says real casual. She says real casual.
Well, I was actually the reporter who I asked them a really simple question, like, what did they think about destination weddings? Were they a fan? Did they like going to them or whatever? Mm-hmm. And Winona Ryder being Winona Ryder goes off on this tangent and is like, you know, Keanu, I think we were married on the set of Dracula. And he's like, what? And she's like, yeah, because it was a real Romanian priest. And, you know, we did the full ceremony because Francis Ford Coppola, the director, wanted us to do that. And, you know, we said our vows. So, like, in the eyes of a Romanian church, we're really married. And Keanu's like, yeah, okay, well, if you say we're married, we're married. And, of course, this went viral. Like, people added Keanu Reeves as Winona's spouse on Wikipedia. It was insane. But it did spark this idea of like, I mean, what if that actually happened? Like, what if two movie stars got married for real by accident on set? And then I was like, but it's not that interesting if it's like Keanu and Winona where they like each other and have a lifelong friendship, like, because they'll just roll with it and then get it annulled when it's convenient. I was like, what if they hate each other and this is the worst possible thing that could ever happen to them? And then I was like, oh my God, that's like the plot of a screwball comedy. And I want to write it in that era of when those types of films were being made. Mm-hmm. And then sort of what sealed the deal was like about a month or so after that, I went to a screening of this film, Merrily We Go to Hell, which is an amazing pre-code film with Frederick March. And during the introduction of that film, Carrie Beecham, who's an incredible film scholar, was talking about how the minister in that film, Neil Dodd, was a real minister. He was ordained but he played ministers in Hollywood films a lot in the 30s and early 40s because he was sort of in that community. He brought his own costume, all this kind of thing. And so I was like, okay, great. Well, there we go. Like,
here's some context.
A real minister working on set. And then we were kind of just off from there.
I love it. And I love it's very much screwball. And I love the dialogue. It already has that snappy, you know, 30s, 40s, like old school vibe. Like even just the dialogue in the book, it really has that vibe to it. I think it really was captured in the language that you're reading, which is great. It really makes you feel like you're there.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me because I really want the experience of reading this book to be like watching It Happen One Night or His Girl Friday or Bringing Up Baby, any of those great classics from the era. Like, I want you to have the feeling and the laughs and all the like bubbly good feelings inside that you get watching one of those movies reading this book.
Well, you definitely have captured that. Like, I was already there, like, feeling high society with Katharine Hepburn and Bing Crosby. Oh, like, I'm getting those banter vibes. Like,
yes, yes. You combined two movies. It was Philadelphia Story, which is Katharine Hepburn, and then the musical remake is High Society with Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly.
Damn it. I'm like, Katharine Hepburn, they're basically the same movie. There's just the non-musical and the non... I was like, Katharine Hepburn, and then, you're right, it is Grace Kelly. But my ability to recall names is just real astounding.
I mean, Philadelphia Story is one of my all-time favorites and definitely an inspiration as well. Like, the chemistry between Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant in that movie is extraordinary.
Ugh, Cary Grant, another man's man.
It's so true. Actually, my in the book, Joan, my heroine, is engaged to another actor who is sort of this matinee idol. And it's a marriage of convenience for them both. And that's how it comes out that she is engaged to, or she's married to Dash Howard, the co-star she hates. And Monty Smith is a combination of Montgomery Clift, but also Cary Grant. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I love it. And I really liked, you learn very quickly on about that marriage of convenience with Monty. And like, I loved it because there are so many true stories of like really famous Hollywood stars in that era who really had to be something else in public and not in private. And it's really, really feel right away like what Dash is going through. Like, he's like, oh, like this is not who I am, but like the studio needs me to be the playboy because that's what gets the paper sold. And like, that's what keeps the momentum going. But like, with this imposter syndrome, like I'm getting so, I can see where you're pulling all like the true life stars into these characters. Like I can really see those parallels. And it really, as someone who also really loves history and finds like who just like will randomly go down rabbit holes, I find it all really interesting. Like, you know, feeling very much like those Rock Hudson vibes and, you know, all of that too. So
yeah, I mean, it was just such a different system of stardom from what we know now, especially with social media, which obviously is still somebody curating what parts of their lives they share with you. But there's an immediacy with stars now and a sense of ownership and familiarity that did not exist in this era. Like,
no.
Stars were made by the studios and then magazines and papers helped sell whatever image the studio assigned to them, whether or not that was true to who they were as a person. And it was such a system and a factory. And you can just imagine how as a human being who is a three-dimensional, nuanced, complicated person, having to adhere to what the studio has decided you are on screen and off would cause a real identity crisis in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I mean, you touch on this again, like immediately you see the impact of the studio on their lives and how they're doing it. And then even just the two characters that hate each other are constantly working together because the studio is like, you're contracted to this sells, you know, and when you do stuff on your own, it doesn't sell. So guess what? You have to go back to this. And Joan just wanting to like get that contract done, do what she needs to fulfill and actually do projects that she is interested in and wants to do and get rid of this. I can only act with Dash. Like I'm only a person if it's with him.
Yeah. And I mean, that was the other thing about the era. A, not that it still isn't today, but it was extremely sexist in mm-hmm. how it saw and dictated the terms of women's lives and their careers and their success. And also not just women, but anyone working for the studio because of the contract system, mm-hmm. you just had so much less control over your career and your image and the projects you were assigned to. And you could say no, but then it would lead to a lot of drama and you getting suspended from your mm-hmm. contract or a lot of legal issues. And so,
yeah, I remember watching a documentary and it was an actor who was like in a lot of like the beach comedy, like the beach uh-huh. rom-com kind of vibes. And he was contracted out and he finally said, no, I want to break this. And the studio demanded he pay all this money back. So he ended up like not acting in movies anymore. He ended up going broke. And at one point he was like I can't remember his name, but he was like one of the biggest stars that we've never wow. heard of, because basically he chose to fight against the contract system because they weren't allowing him to do what he wanted to do. And so he fought against it and broke it and was essentially like made broke and then like never acted again.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing too, is that it was really important to me to both craft the story that would make you feel like you were watching a film of that era and give you that sort of screwball comedy vibe. But I also didn't want to have rose-colored glasses mm-hmm. about the period. I wanted to acknowledge the realities of how the system worked and the pluses and minuses of it and what it would cost people to have stardom in that era and what the terms were of that and what mm-hmm. they were expected to give up. And so much of it is drawn from a lot of biographies I read of real mm-hmm. stars and the very real crises or challenges that they faced. And so, yeah, that I'm really happy to hear you enjoyed that, because yeah, to me, that was the two things. Like I wanted to balance that sense of screwball comedy and feeling like a film of that era with the reality of what it meant to be a movie star on contract with a major studio in the 1930s and 40s.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're doing a great job. I also have a quick question on a history note. Is this Reno yeah. divorce thing? Like, was that a real thing?
Oh, yes. Okay.
So, tell me about this, because I was like, I know Nevada had a reputation, but I didn't know this.
No. So for those listening who haven't read the book, Dash and Joan find out that they're married and they have to go to Reno for 6 weeks to get a divorce so that she can marry the guy she's going to marry in a marriage of convenience. And so, yeah, I think it started in the 20s, but throughout the 30s and a lot of the 40s, it was very, very difficult to get a divorce in a lot of states in America. Mm-hmm. And you would have to go to a judge and show all this evidence. There were like six reasons you could file for a divorce, like mental cruelty, and irreconcilable differences, unfaithfulness, and drunkenness, and something like that. There were like only five or six terms which you could file for divorce on. They were heavily weighted in favor of men. And oftentimes you would have to go through a year-long or more process in court before a judge to get a divorce. And even then, ultimately, the judge decided. And so if he decided not to grant your divorce, you could just have to still be married. And so Reno became this spot where a lot of people went to get divorced, if you could afford it, where you had to establish residency by living there for 6 weeks. But then basically you could like get a lawyer and go to the courthouse and trump up whatever excuse from the six you wanted. Mm-hmm. And they would sign on the dotted line and you would get your divorce. And so there were as we see in the book, there were what were called divorce ranches, where women and men, but mostly women, would go and stay. And that's where they would live for the 6 weeks where they were establishing residency. And it was kind of like a mix of like a dude ranch meets summer camp, where like you would go. There would be like communal dinners every night. There would be these cowboys that worked on the ranch that would host like games or take people on horse rides or lead fishing competitions, all these sorts of things. And so you would go and do that for 6 weeks while you waited for your divorce to be established. Obviously, the more money and resources you had at your disposal, the nicer one of those you could stay at. Mm-hmm. And so it was very popular with not just wealthy people, but with movie stars who wanted to get divorced because they had the money and it was a convenient place they could go and relatively quickly take care of their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Gable, who heavily inspired Dash, stayed at one for a period of time during the 30s, during one of his divorces. There's a picture of him winning a fishing competition.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, and there's a lot of films from the era made about this. So also part of the book is they're making this movie within the book called Reno Rendezvous that Dash and Joan are starring in, and that is about a divorcee in Reno.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very common as well, where one of the other films that inspired the book, The Women from 1939, there's mm-hmm. an extended period in that film where Norma Shearer and Joan Fontaine and Paulette Goddard and several other actresses go and stay at a ranch in Reno so they can get a divorce.
Wow. See, learning something new. I love history. It's just the 30s and old Hollywood was just a wild time. It's just a wild time in California.
Truly. I mean, you could also go to Mexico, but I think people preferred Reno since it was still on American soil.
That's great. Super. Okay. So you've kind of already answered the question because my last question regarding your writing and everything was like, was there more? But now I find out there's a musical in my future.
Yeah. So, I was contracted for a 3-book deal, so there mm-hmm. definitely will be at least 3. I'm in the thick of edits on the second book, which mm-hmm. is actually titled His Girl Hollywood.
Yeah.
and for those that read book one, Arlene is my heroine Joan's assistant, but she's also the screenwriter of the movie they're making in Reno. And she's always dreamed of being a director. So His Girl Hollywood is about her making her directorial debut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a musical. And the leading man is the toast of Broadway, who is also the boy next door that she grew up with, that she Ooh. Was secretly in love with, but has not seen in a decade. So... Mm-hmm. That's that. And then book 3, I have just started drafting. And it is about Flynn Banks, for those that have read the book. It's his love story. And if you buy them and read them, hopefully I will get to write more past that. I definitely have ideas.
Well, I definitely... I'm already excited for number 2. So listeners, you can pick up It Happened One Fight now, I want to say. I can't
July
remember.
11th.
July 11th. And I think this is going to come out either like the day before or 2 days after. So I want to say you can pick it up now. And even if you can't pick it up right this instant, you can pre-order it, which is even better.
Woo!
Gotta love those pre-orders. Super. Well, Maureen, since we're wrapping up, can you tell people where they can find you and find out more about you and keep up to date on this great series?
Yes. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at the Maureen Lee. And I also have a website, maureenleelinker.com, where I post updates. You can also sign up for my newsletter through my website, which I'm trying to get better at regularly sending updates through. So any of those modes of communication, I will definitely be posting updates about it happened one fight, his girl Hollywood, and whatever is to come beyond that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So listeners, go ahead and pick up It Happened One Fight by Maureen Lee Linker.
Hello, folks. Zoe here again, just to say another big thank you so much to Maureen for your time. I loved listening to you and Kelsey chat about all things Hollywood and Bridgerton and your book and your series. I'm super excited. So now that the book is out, I'm going to be picking up a copy. And if you listeners would like to be doing that too, as Kelsey suggested you should right at the end there. There is a handy link in the show notes, or of course, maybe The Ripped Bodice has a copy you could order if you want a physical one, or your local indie bookstore as well. So again, thank you so much to Maureen for your time, and be sure to check out Maureen everywhere you can find her. Finally, if you want to find us, you know that anywhere on social media that we are at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, and our website is romancepod.com. We've got our Patreon at patreon.com/T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, and we're going to be back at you again in 2 weeks, I believe, with a fabulous Julie Anne Long selection from her Palace of Rogue series. We're going to be reading You Were Made to Be Mine. So get reading, get excited. We can't wait to discuss that one with you very soon. And until then, thank you again so much for listening, and may all your ever afters end happily.